Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with a third episode in our John Frusciante Returns series. Over the last couple of months, Rick Rubin and John Frusciante of the Red Hot Chili Peppers have come together to tape an ongoing series of conversations that dives deep into John's philosophical and practical approach to writing music and playing guitar. If you haven't heard the previous episodes, I highly recommend going to check them out. Today, we'll hear John talk about his love of electronic music and how he struggled to fall back in love with guitar-based rock before recording the Peppers' latest set of albums. He also talks about the process of making Californication, and near the end of the interview, picks up a guitar to play through some of his most well-known guitar parts from that album. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and John Frusciante from Shangri-La.
Have you ever taken a principle that you've learned in painting or from another art form and brought it into music?
I think so, but you know, it's not...
It's not specific.
Not conscious, not that I can think of anyways, but those years that I was just painting and drawing and writing in notebooks, that's what made me see how I could make music again, because I thought I was done making music,
yeah.
But it was through doing that and realizing that I was realizing what I was incapable of in that I was capable of in music, like what I wanted to do with that. I didn't have enough I didn't used to appreciate the technical, theoretical and all that. But once I realized what I wanted to do as a visual artist, that I couldn't do it in visual art, it was real clear that I could do exactly that in music.
And do you think it's because you'd spent so much time practicing music before? Is that why that was?
That's why,
had you started as a painter?
Oh yeah, then I would have had that technique.
Yeah. So it's really just the time in, the commitment, previous commitment.
It was strange because I did so much in terms of the thinking, in terms of theory and technique, that by the time I found myself as a guitar player, what I thought I was doing was forgetting about all that stuff.
Yeah.
And when I painted, I continued to just be free. And then when I realized the things I saw in my head I wanted to be able to do, and I knew what aspects of whose styles I wanted to combine, and I didn't have the technical ability to do it. And I thought, God, with music, I can do that. If I want to make something that has like the melodic sense of this person and the rhythmic sense of this person and the, you know, the sound of this person, I know how to do it.
Is that all art? I feel like maybe it is. Like all art is all of the different things that we've taken in and seeing, oh, this aspect of what this person does is really interesting. And this aspect of what they do is interesting.
Yeah.
And this aspect of what someone else does is interesting. And no one has put those together before. And that's a new form. And it's probably the lineage of art has always been built on things of the past shown in a new way that we've never experienced them before.
Yeah. In playing along with other people's music, I constantly notice that somebody's taken one part of one thing and another part of another thing, and they're together. And I don't know if the things were conscious.
Yeah.
But you see it all the time. Yeah, I figure there's just so many combinations, and so we're just spitting them out, and we get them from different places.
And sometimes I imagine it happens by mistake, where you'll, you know, be playing in one style.
Yeah.
And then a mistake will lead you into a different style, but it works, and then it's like, oh, these two styles go together, and I wouldn't have consciously thought that.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you heard that Joe Jackson song? Like, did you hear it within a year of writing?
I was just listening to that record a lot. I mean, I knew, yeah. I was really into his music when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Like, and I was into him since I was a little kid, yeah. Like since I was like 9 or something.
But what's interesting is that for whatever reason, at that moment in time, you were going through a Joe Jackson phase.
Yeah.
The world was not going through a Joe Jackson phase in that moment.
No, yeah.
But you were.
Yeah.
And that was the information that allowed you into a new thing. And I feel like that's where the magical part of it isn't that it comes from the Joe Jackson song. It's that, why were you listening to Joe Jackson then?
Yeah.
And the theory would be because it had the information you needed, even though that's not why you were looking for. Do you know what I'm saying? You weren't listening to it as a reference material. You were listening to it because you liked it.
No, but I particularly liked that record at that time, Beat Crazy, that it's on. I was listening to it a lot. There were certain records. I was really into the new George Michael record as well, that Listen Without Prejudice Volume 1. When we were writing Blood Sugar, I was listening to that all the time. Like, they were just examples of pop music where somebody was going in a direction that was different from what they were known for. Like, Joe Jackson did that even more on his following album. But on that album, there's certain things on it. He has this song called One to One that's like a ballad, a really strong kind of ballad song. It was just different than the kind of power pop. You could tell he was trying to go in a different direction. So I don't know if it was conscious, but it was definitely worked out to be related to what we were doing as far as, you know, with Blood Sugar.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't conscious. And that's what's interesting. It's like that. The way we live in the world impacts the things that we make.
Yeah.
You know, the way we're paying attention, what we're paying attention to, works its way in.
Yeah.
And it's like,
and it often seems like it's the other. We think of causality, that the one causes the other.
Yeah,
and in actuality, you often get the sense that it's the other way around, that you were listening to that thing because you had to write that song.
You know,
like, just to point out for people as far as the space, like, the difference is
what would be the regular way?
It would have been like this.
That's the normal way.
Yeah, that would have been the verse ends, and you go into the chorus and everybody plays on the one, but because of that song, it wasn't just that I wanted the guitar part to go. I wanted Chad to do it with me. I wanted Flea to do it with me. You know what I mean? Like Anthony's the only one who's saying something on the one, which is different from the Joe Jackson where the vocal and the music all are on the two of the bar. So I had that realization that it's just space, basically, that I was taking.
It's fascinating and interesting where these things come from. And it could have also happened in an unconscious way. Like in this case, it's conscious because you know that it happened.
Yeah.
But it also can happen on an unconscious level where, just depending on what you're listening to, there's something that your mind's like, oh, that's interesting. And then later you're writing something, it's like, oh, that's interesting. Do you know what I'm saying? Without it being conscious, it can still happen. And it's not trying to rip anything off. It's like, we are made of the things we listen to.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
That's all
we're made of.
Yeah.
It's not like there's other stuff we're adding on top of what we hear. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like our bank, our reference bank, our files are whatever we've heard that somehow got stored, whether we knew it was getting stored or not.
Yeah.
Joe Jackson's an interesting artist also to talk about, just because even in punk times, I felt like he was an outlier. Like, he wasn't like anyone else.
Yeah, no, his story is really interesting. He wrote a really interesting book. It basically just goes up to where he started having a career, and he had a real strange life up till then. Like, he went to a music school, like, he was reading Beethoven scores when he was a little kid, like, playing in cover groups to make money in pubs for years, like, and had an opportunity to get a record contract and had a clear concept of how the band would look, what the style of music would be, what the songs would be. He had a very calculated approach to being a part of what wound up being like the new wave, you know, post-punk world, but I think wrote some of the best pop songs of the time and really like, but his book only goes up to that point, but it's real. You can't imagine that person winding up doing that, but he had a really good idea about how to fit in with what was going on at the time, you know?
It's interesting.
I think the Police were kind of similar. I think they were such good musicians that what they were playing was a calculated thing based on what was currently going on in England at the time, what was cool at the time.
And it could either be calculated, or when you're a kid and there's a new music movement and you're into it, it's not unusual to morph into it. I know that in my case, I was really into punk rock, and then hip hop came along, and I didn't like punk rock any less, but there was this momentum around hip hop, and it was fun to be part of this other new music scene that seemed related because they were both about not being able to play, really. You know, they were both like more about the content than the virtuosity in both cases.
Yeah. But there were, you know, some people were calculated at the time because the punk thing was this new thing and it's real crappy music. And in the case of the Police and Joe Jackson, their music has tons of heart. It's really good music, you know, like, but I think I've heard from quotes of Sting and from Joe Jackson's book that it really was like, I could do anything that I want to do.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do this specific thing, mix the reggae rhythms with the faster punk rhythms, like, you know, but make pop songs out of that. Like, you know, and in Joe Jackson's case, he wrote all the parts for everybody in his band. There was no... He approached it like a composer, where everything was written, like Frank Zappa or something, where like he tells each person exactly what to play.
I didn't mean to speak disparagingly about it being calculated, because something like the Monkees was a group that was put together.
Yeah.
And I love the Monkees, and I love those songs. And, And there's not a right way to do it. It's whatever yields something that you like to listen to is fine.
Yeah. It's funny how some people, you know... Like, I think Lou Reed's songwriting style that he did in the Velvet Underground, a lot of it came from that he was working for that Pickwick record company, where he's just writing songs on a similar to like a Tin Pan Alley type situation, mm-hmm. where they've just got a lot of writers. They say, write a surf song, write a motorcycle song. You're just sitting there all day cranking out imitations of these trendy things from that time. And I think when he wrote songs like Heroin or Waiting for the Man, he's taking an idea for a song and approaching the writing of the song in the same sort of calculated way, like that this song's about motorcycles, this song's going to be about heroin, being a junkie, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think without that experience of writing songs on an assembly line that he would have ended up writing those types of songs that he did.
And probably the same for the way Andy Warhol eventually made art, where it was more of a, he had the idea for the piece and then it would be crafted essentially by other people because it would be silk screened or some, maybe in some cases he would do the silk screen himself, but it didn't really matter because it was more the idea of the silk screen piece and the composition.
Yeah.
So he composed it, but he didn't have to physically manufacture it.
Yeah. Now that idea of music being manufactured, this is inherent in the whole, our whole, what pop music is to us, that and how it was created, it happened hand in hand with the manufacturing of records and hand in hand with the selling of sheet music as a product. Like pop music, it changes styles, but it doesn't change its basic form. It comes from these things. What existed before that, I don't think has any real direct relationship to pop music, the folk music and stuff like that.
Yeah, even folk music that we think of as like folk music from the 60s on.
It's pop folk.
Yeah, is really all derivative of old folk music and sort of like appropriated from the past.
Yeah.
But presented new to us. Now we look back at 60s as like that was the folk revolution.
Yeah.
But it really was the folk revival.
Yeah. Into the recorded medium, which was a completely different thing.
Yeah. You know?
But yeah, I've always been real conscious. Every time we've made a record, I've always been, as we're moving towards making the record, my mind is thinking, what am I going to play along with? Which means, what am I going to listen to? Because yeah. I sit around playing along with CDs the way a lot of people might sit around reading the newspaper or something. It's just, it's how I relax. And I'm just well aware that the final thing is going to carry aspects of those things in it. But the fun thing is not knowing yeah. what, but seeing
how.
where my imagination is leading me. It is what things am I excited about? What things are giving me intense feelings? And also making sure that there's some kind of variety where the things have a contrast with each other. It's like, well, how am I going to put those things together? But it's got to be things that I pick that I'm excited about it. I wouldn't be able to do it if it was somebody else's idea.
Yeah, on assignment, you know. You couldn't do it.
No.
But it's more just like, it's what you happen to be into. And I yeah. know for anything, if you're going to do a deep dive into anything, I don't know how it's possible to do unless you're really into it. It's not possible.
Yeah.
Could you imagine listening all day to music that you didn't choose to listen to? It'd be terrible.
I can't imagine, yeah.
It'd be crazy making.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, when we started making the new stuff, I sent everybody a ton of music in Dropbox, you know, and like, I don't think anybody listened to anything I said. Like, everybody's got their own ideas about what they need to hear to get them through a creative
period. And that's great, too, because in a way, what makes a band great is not everyone being on the same page. Yeah. It's being able to come together on a page.
Yeah.
But with everyone bringing different, you know, aspects of themselves and what's exciting to them yields something more interesting than what a solo project would be.
Yeah.
Just those combined energies, you know, amplifying something bigger.
Yeah. No, that's the thing. It's like I know that no matter what that combination of things that I'm listening to is, I can't predict what aspects of it are going to be apparent by the time everybody else has done their contributed their part to it.
Do you ever play along to non-guitar based music?
Yeah.
And what does that look like? How does it work? Give me an example and what would you play?
Lots of things. I've had periods where I'm like figuring out the harmonies to Beethoven and Wagner and things like that. Like
I see.
Where if I'm listening to it and I have and I can see in my head how I could approach some of the harmonies in it and get some kind of conception of it, I'd do that. But more often, I guess since I was a kid, I used to figure out like the heads of jazz tunes and stuff like that. But in my adult life, like in the Chili Peppers, I think the thing I've probably done the most is play along with synthesizers, whether it's like I know how to play all the synth parts on all the Depeche Mode records from their first album up through like 94. Like I know every little melody that comes in, I know how to play it. So I can just play along with the same song like 4 or 5 times and every time play it differently because I'm playing with different group of parts. And so, yeah, like there's lots of synth pop that I play along with the synth parts too. There's lots of electronic music and rave music that I play along with the samples or I play along with the synth part or the bass line. So I've done a lot of that. I've also done a lot of playing along with hip hop. When we were making Stadium Arcadium, because it was so simple, I would play it on bass because there was a lot of bass, like bass was there in the stuff I was listening to more than melodies were. And when I'd play bass along with it, I'd just play with my pinky because I was trying to strengthen up my pinky. So I'd do the whole thing with just the one finger, with the weakest finger. And then there's certain things that I just make a conscious effort. Okay, I'm not going to play along with that. I can usually see in my head how you would play along with it, but it's nice to have a couple of things you just never play along with.
Yeah.
Like I used to really like REM at the time that we did Californication, but I had a rule for myself. I just never played along with them. And at the time, by the way, I really liked the band Hanoi Rocks a lot. I was listening to them a lot, but I never played along with them. Like I just didn't want to do it.
Hanoi Rocks was an interesting out of time band.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're just, they're more like a post-glam thing. They're not really like an 80s heavy metal thing.
They're too late to be glam and too early to be hair metal.
Yeah. No, I always thought, I liked them since I was a teenager. There was just like, there's something really fun about their music to me.
I like the bands that don't fit anywhere. There's always something interesting when either a band is part of a scene that they don't really belong in, like Joe Jackson would be an example. Yeah. It's not obvious that he belonged in that scene, even though he was popular in that scene.
Yeah.
Or where there is no scene associated, where it's just sort of a fringy thing. Like I think of the, or albums that don't sound like other albums, the Love Forever Changes album is one of my favorite albums, and I don't know any other albums particularly like that.
Nothing sounds like that.
And it's so good, and it's so one of a kind. Like, how come there's not 50 more like that in the wake of that?
Yeah.
It's just a singular thing.
Yeah. No, there's a lot. Jungle is probably my favorite kind of music, and I collect it, and the stuff from like 92 to 96. And every so often, there's a song. The musical style of it, there's not one other song that's like that one song. Yeah. You find these weird, a lot of it's similar to each other in certain ways. And then there's certain songs that somebody could have nabbed that and it could have become a trend, but it just never did. And it just winds up being this one obscure song that doesn't sound like anything else. That's also when you're into something, you notice those differences more, you know. Yeah. It, to somebody else, that Forever Changes might just sound same as like a folk rock, any other folk rock album, you know. Like, it's when you really like something, I feel like you wind up zoning into the details of it that make one thing dissimilar.
Do you decide on a new for you old genre of music to dive into deeply at times? Does that come up where, like, I'm going to really research a particular style of music?
Only if I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Do you remember the last one?
The last one. I don't know. The only thing that's popping into my head is Ghetto House from Chicago. Like, it developed into a style called juke and then a style called footwork. And I was really into footwork when I first heard that. But I wasn't aware of the Ghetto House that it had come from, that the people who made footwork had been listening to when they were growing up, you know. But I mean, I got into it like 7 years ago or something like that.
Is it a blend of rap and house?
Not rap, because it's repetitive and the lyrics are generally kind of funny, dirty sex lyrics, but one sample of something repeated. So it's spoken, it's not really rapping, but it's because there's no flow really. It's just a sentence or a phrase that keeps getting repeated over and over and over. It comes from Chicago house music. So you have like Chicago Acid, and then you have this label Dance Mania that was a Chicago label that kept developing as the music was developing at the time. And Ghetto House was one of the things it developed into. And there's nothing fancy about it. It's like a real simple version of funk. It's like it's a really strange kind of electronic funk that's very minimal. It'll usually be like, you know, a bass line, a simple drum part, maybe one simple synth melody, one sample. They get a lot of mileage out of very little. And with my electronic music, I'm so into being fancy that I really enjoy listening to people who can say so much so simply and with so little effects, so little programming, to have a loop that feels good, that's just one bar going over and over, but it's really funky and you want to hear it over and over, or a sample that you want to hear the same sample over and over.
Really
hard. Yeah. And for them, it came naturally. So it's fascinating music for me to listen to. So, you know, I feel like joining the band again this time, it was really sort of about going back to, I was trying to figure out what out of rock music would I be interested in now? Cause I just listened to this, you know, I'd be on a drive home from the dentist and I'd listen to the Rolling Stones and I'd think, God, that was really cool. I used to make meaningful kind of music like this with the band, you know, like as much as I love electronic music, there would be certain things, whether it was like Peter Hamill and Van der Graaf Generator, or I'd listen to a record now and then, and it just had a certain sort of meaningfulness, like sometimes like makes you cry or gives you chills in this way that's a different feeling from what I get from electronic music, and that feeling of vulnerability and the of the human being that's doing it, because you don't have the machine in between. But I didn't specifically, I wasn't obsessed with any rock music in particular. I would just listen to this now and then, you know, or that. So when I rejoined, I had to start to figure out, okay, what out of rock music would I actually be like, want to hear over and over and be excited about, you know?
What was it? What was the thing that?
Not too many things. Like, yeah.
I know 50s music really came back.
Yeah, 50s was the thing. But that was the thing that in general was the most exciting to me when I rejoined this time, was just like, because of the purity of it, and because of the feeling that it was new and the state of mind I was in. All other rock music after, say, like 1959 sounded to me like a fake version of the real thing. Yeah. It was only the things from like 56 through 59 that sounded authentic to me.
I think AC/DC felt that way the whole entirety of their career.
Right.
That, like, music ended sort of with Chuck Berry. Like, yeah. Everything post-Chuck Berry doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'd never seen it exactly from that perspective until whatever that was, 2020, that the band started playing together and I started writing music with them. I was like, wow, the only rock music that really, that does the same thing for me that electronic music does emotionally is the 50s stuff. Because it's the same with electronic music. I like, my favorite things are when a style has just blossomed, when they've just come across a certain way of doing things and a certain kind of spirit and emotion and style. I like it for that first two or three years that they're doing it, and then I don't like it. I like whatever the thing was that came a few years after that, where somebody was influenced by it but was doing something completely different. Generally, I'm not saying that's 100% true, but that's generally how my taste is with electronic music. I like
too,
a particular style for like three years.
And I would
years.
Say that's true for all music, not right. even just electronic music. Because
right.
like I'll get interested in something, and then once it becomes regular to me, it's less interesting.
Right. Yeah, when you can expect what people are going to do, but there's a certain freshness that comes from, wow, nobody's ever sounded like this, you know? Because there was great R&B in the early 50s, but that thing that Elvis was doing, there's not somebody else that sounds like that before him. Yeah, he's influenced by things, but that sound, what he was doing with his voice, the way those musicians were playing together, those precise kind of rhythms, there just wasn't something that sounded like that. So if you're studying what came before and you're familiar with it, and then you hear that, you can see, wow, you can put yourself in the time and place of what that would have felt like at the time. And Buddy Holly's songwriting and stuff like that, it was just, and the way Johnny Guitar Watson played guitar, like where it's distorted and mean and fucked up sounding, like nasty before him. I don't know if I know a lot of like electric blues players who were playing before him. Nobody was that nasty as that. Like it's really, there's a few people, Clarence Gatemouth Brown and who was going for a while before Johnny Guitar Watson. And I guess he got to a point where he was having a similar kind of nastiness, but yeah, there's these certain things when they first come up. So I was so into those kind of players that stuff like Cream and the Yardbirds wasn't seeming as exciting to me or Jimi Hendrix even, like, wasn't sounding as exciting as the people that they were listening to, because that's where I heard that freshness. So I was definitely into 50s music the whole time, but also Susie and the Banshees sounded good to me right away, right when I rejoined, and that was something I was enjoying playing along with a lot. And gradually, as the band played together more, and as I started to see the direction that we were going, because having no idea of what that was going to be at first, it was hard. But as time went by, I started getting into more like psychedelic things and stuff.
It's interesting how regardless of the influences, going back to what you were listening to, let's say, on Californication up through now, the influences could change wildly over the years, and you and the band sound like you and the band.
Yeah.
Which is great. Do you know what? It's like it's beautiful that the new inspirations can open new channels, but they don't change who you are. You know, like they don't make it a different band.
Yeah. Nothing can change your spirit. I always say I've never heard a musician sound like another musician. For all the talk that people do about this person stole from that person, I've never heard one other musician sound like another musician. Yeah. I've seen people try to, and they don't.
No.
Like, and that even goes for electronic music. Even when it's drum machines and synthesizers, I've heard plenty of people try to imitate, say, Aphex Twin, and I've never heard somebody actually sound like him. Like, the human spirit, it's unique to each person, and a person's soul is unique to them. And I think you're stuck with that. You're stuck with whoever you are as a soul. You can use influences to give you ideas or to guide your ideas in different directions that you might not have gone otherwise. But the one thing that you can't avoid is sounding like yourself.
And I would say the opposite side of being stuck with it is it's the reason for you to make art. Because if you don't do it, no one else can play your part.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's like only you can play what you play, whatever that is, and what you bring to it, that's your sound.
Yeah.
And maybe in the beginning, it might be based on other people's sounds until you find really what your direction is, because most people making music might start by copying someone else.
Yeah.
But very quickly, that falls away into being who you are.
Yeah. Yeah, like all through being a teenager, I was definitely obsessed with trying to be just like certain musicians. But I always, looking back, I sounded like me. It was me playing a different style.
Yeah,
I hadn't found a style of my own, but the spirit of it still sounded like me. I didn't sound like those other people. I couldn't. Yeah.
It's not that we have to find our own sound, because our own sound is there. It's when the influences start falling away, what's left is your sound. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's less of a discovery and more of a coming into who we are.
Yeah. But yeah, Syd Barrett, like Bad Brains, Nirvana, I gradually started like seeing a connection between what I wanted to do, you know, on what became our new records and that stuff, and was just, and I'm just moved by it. Like it, but I've never been into so little rock music as I was when we made these records. I had to really strive to like find like, okay, what can get me excited about it? Just because, like I said, I would get excited about it in bursts. I've never loved it any less, but
Understood.
I just wasn't as obsessed with it. I get more obsessed with electronic music.
We're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back with more from Rick Rubin and John Frusciante. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah. Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with more from Rick Rubin and John Frusciante.
How has playing live changed from the earliest days in the band to now for you?
Well, as we discussed, like the first 6 months, I didn't know what to do with myself up there. I was really nervous and just confused.
Maybe in relation to the music more than how to be. Do you know what I mean?
I guess if I'm thinking like from Californication on, like it really hasn't changed that much. You know, playing live is just a more intense version of what we do in the studio, and I don't feel like my basic approach to it has changed because it has so much room to be in the moment and to do things that are unique. At that point, I was excited about playing live and I was experimenting. Like on Blood Sugar Tour, I wasn't super excited to be playing live, but I was doing real neat sort of experimenting on stage and stuff. But from Californication on, it's like I'm exploring things. And I'm excited to be there. So it's got that same indifference that I had on the Blood Sugar Tour where I'm not worried if I fuck up or if the energy falls apart for a second, I'm not worried about it. But it's backed by like enthusiasm about playing with the guys and about.
So how different would you say it is from night to night for you? I didn't mean enthusiasm wise. I mean like musically, how would you say?
Well, Flea and Chad and I are improvising like all the time.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Like,
I feel like no bands do that. Right. I don't know of any other bands that do. I mean, jazz bands do that, but I don't know of big rock bands playing for a lot of people who do that.
Yeah. And certain songs allow for it more than others for me.
Yeah.
Flea, I think, is improvising from the beginning of the show till the end of the show.
Yeah.
Like there's the bass parts are almost all kind of built for that.
Yes.
And Chad, I notice, especially right now, he's doing it more. He's more sensitive to us than he ever was in the past. Like he's interacting with us in ways that I don't remember him doing in any of the previous times I was in the band. He held things together and he pushed us and all that, but he wasn't listening to us in the way that he listens now.
Yeah.
Like he's really sensitive as a person too. He has a sensitivity that I did not associate him with having anything like that when I rejoined, you know,
he's an incredible musician.
Yeah.
He's an incredible musician.
We're always really listening to each other. And for me on guitar, there's certain songs where like, the chords are the chords and I have to play the chords. But even with those, maybe nobody notices, but I'm putting notes in the chords that weren't in the chord on the record. There's sometimes the difference is subtle and sometimes the difference is extreme. And this is just in the guitar parts. Like, yeah. Flea and I are always throwing in little extra riffs. Like, Anthony says a line and Flea does a little riff, and then he says another line, and I do a little riff, sort of imitation of what Flea did or something, you know, or I'll do something, some certain weird kind of fast rhythm in a solo, and then Chad responds by doing that same rhythm as a drum fill. Like, it's not just during the instrumental sections that we're improvising. We're doing it all the time.
And can you hear each other well enough to be able to play off each other in that way?
Yeah, we can hear each other really well.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm always surprised. Chad really hears every little thing I do. Like, there's tons of moments during the show where I do something that I think is subtle that he's not going to notice. And he either shows me that he notices by playing a certain thing in response, or by looking at me a certain way or something.
And then depending on how Flea does something new, might that impact what you do new in relation to it?
Yeah, exactly. Like
just bouncing off each other's ideas all the time.
That's what we're always doing. Yeah. So
must keep it so fresh.
It does. Like, the set list always changes, but I feel like even if it didn't, I would be creatively satisfied up there, because it, that type of interaction, it means so much to me, especially because the weird part of it is that nothing ever falls apart. Like, we're doing all these things that are only done that one time, and doing all this kind of interaction, and you can never quite predict what the other guys are going to do. And yet we play like we're one entity.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially playing in these big stadiums, you're aware, like, the details of what you're doing aren't even that important. The important thing is that you make one sound together. And so if I'm hitting the guitar and Chad's hitting the snare and Flea's hitting the bass all at the same time, that's one big sound that goes out there to the back, to the people in the back.
It's like how the pieces fit together.
Yeah. Yeah. So to be able to have that, and to be able to make it spontaneous at the same time, is just a unique thing that we've developed over the years.
And to do it in the context of familiar songs that the audience can sing along with the whole time.
Yeah.
So it doesn't stray so far. I mean, the song is still the song, but it's more like the song is the scaffolding to allow all of the interesting playing to happen.
Yeah. And we're always listening to Anthony. Like, the important thing, it's part of the challenge of it. If Anthony wasn't singing the vocals and depending on us to give him a proper groove,
yeah,
we would go further out. Yeah. But
got to keep it the song.
Because he's there, I make sure if I'm going to do some unexpected thing and he's going to come in singing right after I do it, I better be right on time, you know? Like, yeah. I better nail this new rhythm that I'm trying to do, because he's got to come in the right groove and he's got to be feeling the right thing before he comes in. So you're always making sure to support everybody else and to not go off on such a tangent that you're throwing anybody else off.
Sounds super fun.
It really is.
Yeah. It just sounds like the most fun playing music.
Yeah, I never knew growing up that it could be like that. I don't think there were any bands that I was into that had that exact thing, where everybody's really listening and changing in subtle ways all the time. It's in a different way, but the T-shirt I'm wearing, King Crimson, that lineup of them was really good in that way. Like, they, like that. When I think of who did I like when I was a teenager that showed me that was possible, that's probably the closest thing.
Yeah.
Most groups when I was growing up, you just assume that the song is the song and the band plays the song. It might sound different for one reason or another, but.
And for most bands, that's what it was.
Yeah.
For most bands, that's what it was. That's why I feel like the Chili Peppers is such an unusual thing live. There's so much more life in it than the live version of the record.
Right.
It's so much more musical. Even when you can't hear what's different, I subconsciously feel there's more going on.
Right.
And it doesn't feel like more's going on and it's screwing it up, which can also happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like that. It feels like a mind expanded version of it.
Yeah. In learning other people's music, I always notice that there's sometimes the hardest things to memorize are apparently very simple things. Like, it's much easier to learn what sounds like an impressive kind of busy guitar solo than it is to learn a rhythm guitar part that doesn't repeat itself too much, that keeps changing in subtle little ways for 5 minutes straight.
Yeah.
That's actually a lot harder for the brain to memorize. What sounds like it's the easiest thing in the world would actually be a real pain in the ass to sit there and memorize in comparison to what sounds like a hard to play solo.
Yeah. And, it's also possible that the guitarist who's playing it doesn't even know it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean is to memorize something. Because those are
that's not really a part so much as somebody playing along to something.
Like say Funkadelic like has a lot of stuff like this where they're guys in a room jamming with each other and it became a song, but there wasn't a flat like this is the guitar part, you repeat this every four bars, like that's the verse, the other there's a lot of sort of rhythm guitar parts that just they flow from the beginning of the song to the end. They're not a repetitive pattern, but feels like a groove from beginning to end. You know what I mean? Like those things, there's something in the brain that just doesn't want to memorize something when it's that simple, yet it keeps changing.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful to listen to. It's like it feels more like you're looking at the ocean or watching the clouds move in the sky or something to listen to something like that.
It's got a much more natural, random quality that's more real than the same perfect cloud every time. What would it be like if every wave was the same wave?
Yeah.
It's not so interesting.
Yeah. So it's the kind of things like Chad notices when I'm playing a funk rhythm and the funk rhythm on the record is one thing and I'm playing a different rhythm. He hears that I'm doing a unique thing that's only happening on that one night. Could be nobody in the audience even notices that I'm doing anything different because it still sounds like the song, you know?
Yeah.
We have to take another quick break here, and then we'll come back with more from Rick Rubin and John Frusciante, who will play through some of his most well-known guitar parts and dissect them.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with Frusciante.
I thought it would be fun. I just wrote, before I came here, I wrote down a bunch of songs to talk about the guitar parts, just to see what comes up.
Okay, you know, hopefully I remember them.
Yeah. And if not, we can even listen to a little reference.
Yeah, if I hear it.
I started with Californication because I think that's where we left off our conversation, I think. Did we talk everything about Californication last time, or just...
I feel like we touched on it, but it wouldn't hurt if we're gonna go through the other, through Californication, by the way, and Stadium. It might be good to talk a bit about more about Californication.
Yeah. So going into that project, you're back in the band. I remember we talked about you being out of the band. I think we talked about you coming back to the band.
Yeah. Right. I think where we left off when we talked about it was I was kind of talking about how my technique wasn't where it had been.
Yep.
So I had to come up with a different style of playing and be inspired by more like new wave guitar players, mm-hmm. as opposed to Guitar Hero kind of guitar players, and found a style from that. When they asked me to be in the group again, like, especially at that time, I had for years at that point thought I would never make music again. And even when I did start to want to make music, didn't feel that I could ever make music that would touch people again. Didn't feel I could make a good sound with my voice anymore. I'd had extensive dental stuff and singing was much more difficult than it had ever been. And didn't feel that I could ever again make a beautiful sound with my voice. And felt like I was missing whatever that thing was that had once been able to touch people with music. And yet, to those guys, I was the same as I'd ever been. Like, yeah. And I don't think I had any other friends who saw me that way. You know, like Anthony and Flea specifically, like their belief in me made me able to be reborn at that time. Like, I had tried to start bands with other people and stuff like that. There was no magic in it, no magic coming from me. And from playing with them, I started to feel like I was generating magic, you know, like it was a really neat time in that way. And especially because we really believed in ourselves and what we were doing, even if like the record company didn't seem particularly interested, you know, like mm-hmm. we were just very excited about what we were doing and ended up carrying us through, you know. Yeah, and the real exciting thing for me about that time was just sort of starting from a place where we were able to take those melodic sort of ideas that we'd done on the slower, softer songs on Blood Sugar and combine that with the energy of the other types of funk things that we did. And for me to be able to play guitar in a way that has some blues aspects in some parts, but had more of an influence coming from the late 70s and early 80s new wave, what's now called post-punk, that I was finding ways to incorporate those influences more than I had previously. And I was depending on Hillel's style less than I ever had. Like, I was able to really like find a, like there was a place for that Hillel influenced stuff. It's certainly there on Californication, but all those things like Californication and Other Side and Easily and, you know, all these songs, they were just, I felt like it was a style that I was creating specifically for the band, and I hadn't heard those things go together before, you know. I'd had a fixed idea of what Flea's role is supposed to be or what my role is supposed to be. And I just started to be able to find that I could put those things aside, you know, scar tissue, just play things that really sounded like nobody but me. And it worked really perfectly in the context of the band, and everybody just made it better.
And it did seem like some of the influence, writing-wise, were more from synth-based bands. You're playing guitars in the band, but the songwriting didn't necessarily sound like guitar-based music.
Yeah, because my favorite music at that time was like Massive Attack and Tricky and Depeche Mode and The Human League, and I was listening to all this electronic music. It was actually really hard at first because, similar to what I was saying about the current time in a different way, when I first joined, I found rehearsal seemed really boring if I listened to the kind of music I liked to listen to before I went to rehearsal. So like if I started my day listening to like Depeche Mode and Massive Attack, if I went to rehearsal, I would just be sitting there thinking, God, we sound really boring. And, you know, like this sounds like it didn't have anything texturally interesting about mm-hmm. it. It seemed like a bland kind of color. Uh-huh. So I had to force myself to listen to guitar-based music. And I found that there were a small amount of certain guitar-based things that seemed, to my ear, seemed as colorful as Depeche Mode and yeah. those things I mentioned. Yeah. But it wasn't a whole lot of rock things again. You know, it was when I would get home from rehearsal, the first thing I'd do would be put on Depeche Mode, you know, like that was really what I wanted to hear, and would have loved to go to rehearsal and have a drum machine guy sitting there, you know, like yeah. I was really wanting to hear drum machines. But that pattern worked out really well because those things, because I could warm up to the Ramones I was really into, warm up to the Ramones and Fugazi and the Yardbirds and stuff, and then go to rehearsal. And something about that combination of that, on one hand, I'm inspired by these other people who have done things with guitar, and on the other hand, the melodic things that are exciting to me are coming from this other style of music that's done with other types of gear.
Did you ever hear the acoustic Depeche Mode demos?
Yeah, I'm familiar with some of their demos, bootlegs of them and stuff.
They're acoustic ones where it's either on the piano or guitar. And yeah. It's interesting because I think most of the songs were written with traditional instruments and then turned into Depeche Mode songs.
Yeah. But yeah, in the early days, Martin Gore used to make like synth demos that were pretty developed. Like he must have done them on like a 4-track or an 8-track or something. And a lot of those, they're kind of just like a shittier sounding version of what wound up on the record. But I think as time went by, he started bringing the songs in more just on guitar, so the producer and Alan Wilder and stuff could come up more with more of an electronic vision of it. They got really good results from doing it that way. Both ways, though. But anyways, yeah, so the sense of melody there on Californication had definitely more of a, even though the sound of the band is more like 60s, 70s music, the melodic aspect had a lot more to do with things that were more modern at the time.
Can you grab the guitar? Because there's, we could talk about like a song like, let's talk about Other Side. That'd be a good one too.
That guitar part, you can't play it without the bass part.
Because that's fine.
Because it's, it wouldn't sound.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the song. No. It just sounds like a part of.
It's just, because we're. Yeah, he's playing notes that are basically the same, but they're different notes, but they're basically the same rhythm.
But together it forms a
together
like a
they
chord.
Form a chord. Yeah.
How'd that get written? How did it come to be like that?
I came in with something like that. It was those chords.
Yeah.
And then I think I started by playing them, but I had a plan before I had even gone in. I was like, I'm going to start with those chords, but I'm going to wait for him to start to fuck around with it. And then I'm going to start. I think I already had that melody in my head. I knew that melody would sound good with those chords.
Yeah.
So I started playing them, figuring he would pick up on the chords.
Are all of the songs that work where it's the guitar and the bass making chords, do they always start as, on the writing side, do they start as traditional chords that then turn into?
I don't know about always, because we did that with something like Other Side, and we gradually realized that that was a thing we could do.
So you could start writing in that style without ever starting with the original chords.
I think so.
That's interesting.
I think so, because I'm pretty sure when we're doing it later on the song, By the Way,
yeah,
I don't think we'd figured out the chords. I think maybe the chords still, that was still sort of our version of the chords from the chorus. I know that they're not exactly the chords from the chorus and the intro to By the Way. There's definitely like we were, it was looser, a looser interpretation of it than, but I know it is a way that we can play now. Like we do our Californication intro where we're just like playing, you know, fast notes all at the same time and playing different things. And still we like lock up again. There is a chord change that's implied in it. Yeah, it does help to have to be able to do that on a guitar and a bass. It's good to have an invisible chord that you both know what it is.
Yeah,
you know,
because then you know the framework style of where you can go.
Yeah, and it makes you be able to sound connected.
Yeah,
even though there's no apparent reason to the listener why you should be connected, because you seem to both be doing different things, but you're both thinking A minor, F, whatever it is.
And that what's interesting about that is, that's like Depeche Mode writing a song on guitar or piano,
right?
And turning it into a Depeche Mode song where the chords are implied, even though there might not be an instrument playing the chords.
Exactly.
The composition of the different sounds give you the feeling that there's a chord happening, but it's an invisible chord.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I think that Californication time, I was so excited about what happened when we just walked into a room together and started playing, as opposed to sitting there with the whole thing of like, well, here's my song I wrote at home. I'm going to show it to you. Like, I wanted to try to avoid that. I felt like that whole setup and that whole like, because I used to play games with it at Blood Sugar time. I had this act I would put on where I would act like what I was about to play was shitty. I thought it was good, but I found that I was getting the best reaction from them if I acted like it was some no big deal. You know, they were more supportive of it or something. So there would always be this setup to it. So by Flea did the same thing. I mean, I don't know how much of an act necessarily, but yeah, like it really used to feel like if you acted like you were not confident with what you were doing, or if you weren't confident in what you were doing, the other guys would be supportive of you and stuff. And whereas if you walked in and said like, I got this riff, it's the best fucking riff you ever heard in your life, you just weren't going to get a good reaction from them, you know?
It's so funny.
So
by Californication,
I'm starting to realize I don't have to say anything. I can come in with those, because I don't know how I knew those would go, but maybe I'd recorded them on a cassette recorder and I was probably playing these chords and I was playing guitar to the cassette recorder and I was probably going bum 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 bum. So I knew the two things went together good, but I was like, I'm not going to go in and show Flea. So, hey man, play A, F, C, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just going to go in and play the chords and see what happens. And, you know, like,
and he plays what he
10
plays.
Minutes later, like we had this beautiful, you know, thing where we're weaving in and out of each other and he's going up when I'm going down and all, you know, it's just like.
When I hear it, it definitely makes me wonder how it happens.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not that it works together so magically that without me knowing that there is an invisible chord at play behind the scenes, it's impossible to even know how anything like that ever gets written.
Right. Yeah. It's cool when you take away the source of where something came from, you know, like, it's a good device in songwriting.
And in that song, is it just those chords over and over again? Because the chorus is the same,
no? Yeah, exactly, it is.
So it changes from the verse to the chorus.
Well, there's the bridge is different. But the chorus and the verse are basically the same chord progression.
The sparse version and the chord version.
Yeah, I don't even know if I actually fully play the chords. I think Flea just plays differently. Let's see. Oh, no, the verse is different, sorry. Yeah, the verse has a different guitar part. It's a. Yeah, that's the verse guitar part. So that other part is the chorus. And rather than play the chords, Flea and I had that thing worked out that we did.
And then that verse also feels like that would also make the guitar part in the chorus seem less like it's related to chords. Because what you just played for the verse doesn't seem related to chords.
It is. It's A to E.
Okay.
You know,
it feels more like a riff because of the way you're playing it.
Yeah. Because that, I like that idea. I like of putting big intervals between the notes in a guitar, using the guitar itself to create a sense of space. So with that guitar, those two notes are so far apart from each other and there's so much space between them. It seemed like it gives space to the rest of the band to fill it in, as opposed to if I was playing the full chord, it would be like, you know, it's to me, that's less meaning. There's more going on and it's less meaningful. So, so I really liked that guitarist, Ricky Wilson from the B-52s. He had this way of playing where he only had four strings. He had the low two strings and the high two strings were tuned to the same note, and he had no G string and no D string. And he would essentially be playing two different guitar parts at the same time, because it sounds like two different guitar parts, because he's sort of playing a bar chord on the low strings, and then the high strings, he's playing a kind of a melody. And it gave him a real unique right-hand style to be able to do that, because sometimes they alternate. The right hand alternates from the high string to the low string to the high string. Sometimes they play at the same time. So they have two separate motions to them. So that was somebody who I know I was inspired by in that way. But it's something I'd just been messing around with even at Blood Sugar Time. When I first did it, it was inspired by listening to him. But that whole sort of style of playing where you're going like, like
it leaves so much space.
It creates all this space, and it makes it fun to just play guitar by yourself, because you're kind of doing a bass part and you're doing a melody part.
Mm-hmm. But it's really different than finger picking.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's simpler. But I used to just find it was fun to just.
It's more like piano in a way.
Just improvise. It's like playing piano with one finger on each hand, basically. Yeah.
Super simple piano.
Yeah. So that other side verse part definitely comes from thinking that way. And Scar Tissue, it's the same kind of thing. Same kind of thing. Just wanting to put big intervals between things. Because I'd always, you know, play along with music all the time. There's certain things like that I'd wonder, like, I'd notice, like, not that many people have done this for some reason. It's a stupid thing, you know? It's like, it's nothing complicated or anything, but I just hadn't heard a lot of people doing it. So I'm always on the lookout for things like that. Like, what somebody maybe hinted at, but hasn't really done that much. I think some of my references for playing like that, Eric Avery and Jane's Addiction, had a couple of bass lines that were like that. He has that thing, and I think Summertime Rolls has a bass line kind of like, I Would For You has a bass line that I think has those kind of distances in it. He would kind of play these. He had a few songs where he'd have these like big intervals like that on his bass, and I thought that would be cool to do on guitar.
Yeah,
you know,
so cool.
Yeah.
Parallel Universe.
So again, that one is Flea and I sort of playing in harmony with one another, and that's actually I don't think there was a chord. I don't even remember which of us was playing first, but one of us was playing and the other played to that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And definitely Fugazi.
Was there any discussion about it being rhythmically unison for the whole song, or did that just sort of happen? It started and never stopped.
Yeah, there definitely wasn't discussion that it would be cool. You know, It's hard to remember exactly how that came about. I remember writing the chorus at home. I think that was probably like pretty like Nirvana inspired, you know. Like, you know, they have these songs like... it's called Even in His Youth. That's a song, so same key, like... They have another song that goes... I really liked those songs that had that sort of minor kind of dark feeling.
They don't sound at all the same to me, but it's interesting that they do that.
Yeah, I think in my mind, I was like, I would write something like Even in His Youth, and that was the...
That seems more like Ramones-y anthemic to me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also listening to the Ramones a lot at that time. Also, you know, for me to say, I think I used to kind of try to hide the Nirvana influence because I felt like they were our contemporaries and I didn't want people to know how much I loved them. But like I mentioned to you before, like when I was down and out and there was like all those years where there was no future, their music, along with a few other people like David Bowie and Black Sabbath, it just meant the world to me. It just meant everything to me. And partially in their case, because I felt like it was something I'd felt inside me since I was a kid, because I loved punk. Punk was the music that got me into playing guitar, but also loved all different kinds of pop music and stuff. So for somebody to combine punk with pop as well as they did, it just... And somebody to be that good of a screamer, because Darby Crash was my favorite singer when I was a kid. And then, so to have somebody who's screaming like as good as Darby Crash, yet he's singing like melodically in this way that Darby didn't really sing. Yeah, their music just meant a lot to me. So
I remember them opening for you. Was that on the Blood Sugar tour that they were opening for you?
Only for three shows.
Oh, I must have been on all three shows then, because for me, it felt like, oh, they're on the tour.
Yeah, I was in California only. But I wasn't into them then. I resented the whole idea of a pop punk thing at the time.
Like I was. It's so funny.
Yeah, I didn't like them till after he'd already died.
Like, wow.
Yeah, he just died. I think when I started to Tony Oswald started playing. I first heard them when I was in a rehab, and I mean when I first heard them and liked them, I was in a rehab, and that In Utero album had come out, and she played me the song Rape Me over the telephone, and I was stuck in a rehab for 30 days, and I kept calling her up going, play me that song again. Just play, like, however it sounded on the phone, I just had to hear it again. I loved it so much. Yeah, it was really that In Utero. It might have been before he died. No, I think it was still after he died, but I just hadn't heard that album In Utero, and that was and I still think that's their best album, and that was what got me real excited about them. Yeah, maybe the things about Nevermind that Kurt himself didn't like were the things that didn't appeal to me about it when it came out or something. Because once I heard them sound actually like raw and sound like just like guys playing in a room, that's when I realized. And I didn't even watch them when they opened for us. I was just in my own head. And so anyway, so I saw that chorus as like Nirvana thing. But like I said...
A lot of times the things we love, we don't hit us right at first.
Yeah.
That's not unusual at all.
Yeah, I know it was that way for you with the Ramones.
Yeah, it just made me laugh.
Yeah. But anyways, being into punk since I was a kid, it was like, once I got into them, I was surprised that I hadn't landed on these ideas like when I first joined the band. You know, this way of sort of combining punk and pop, because like... I just thought the band didn't want to be, I didn't even think the Red Hot Chili Peppers would want to do something like that anyways, you know, like I wouldn't have thought.
And they might not have wanted to right when you joined, actually, if you think about it, because it wasn't until, it took time for it to, for the mold to open of what the Chili Peppers could be.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have suited really the way Anthony was singing then.
Yeah.
You know, like it took time for it to turn into anything we like.
Yeah.
You know, that took time.
Yeah. But anyways, it came real naturally. That song It's definitely a combination of Fugazi and Nirvana in my mind. Like, probably quite a bit of our songs I could sum up in ways like that. I could say it's a combination of this artist and that artist or whatever. But really, yeah,
but it does still
sounds like us.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't sound like either of them.
Yeah.
What is the verse guitar part in Parallel Universe?
It's like hard to play on this, but... It doesn't sound like anything without
sound like
the bass.
Yes, it doesn't sound like music without the bass. It's so interesting, though. But when they're together, it's so unique and so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that one, it might have come up in a similar way to Other Side with me coming in with chords, but somehow I don't think so. I think Flea was probably playing that on the bass. And
do you know what his part is? You know... That does sound more root.
Yeah, that you can hear the music more. My part doesn't even sound like the song, like unless you hear it with that part.
But the harmony makes the whole thing feel like thick.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like his part, you hear the song in it. Yeah, because he's playing the root notes and I'm playing the different intervals. But yeah, I guess come to think of it, that it must have been that I liked those three notes of even in his youth. So I wanted to do something with those that started with that basic tonality.
I see.
But the way I'm strumming it is like the Ramones. It's all downstrokes. And I was playing along with the Ramones every day. It was good for my rhythm hand. It got me stronger and stronger as we rehearsed. I kept being able to do downstrokes faster and faster and became friends with Johnny Ramone at that time, which also had an influence on me in a lot of ways. He's the person who got me into 50s music. So I started like I learned all the guitar solos on all the Ricky Nelson songs.
Were you already into old movies before Johnny Ramone, or was Johnny really the...
No, I was into old movies, but he was able to show me a lot more about them and stuff that I didn't know. Like he used to give me Humphrey Bogart movies that he would record off TV when they would show a rare one and stuff. Mm-hmm. And got me into collecting.
You're such an interesting person. Yeah. I really miss him.
Yeah, me too.
He's one of the more interesting people I've ever met.
Yeah, no, it's really true.
Very knew what he liked. Yeah. Very, you know what I mean? Like very saw the world his way clearly.
Yeah. He was very sure of it. Yeah. And he didn't mind if you disagreed with him.
No, not at all.
At all.
Not at all.
And at the same time, it
didn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just couldn't see how anyone could see it differently.
Yeah, he would just say, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, he's like, I think I know more about this than you.
I saw that you did one of the Ramones songs at Flea's thing last week, and I saw a little clip.
Right.
Linda sent me. It was so beautiful.
Thanks. Yeah. I've done it a few times now. I did it once for the day that he died, once for his birthday, which came not long after that, and then the other day because DH died, and because Linda was there. So.
Yeah. I didn't know that DH died.
You didn't know DH died? Oh, yeah. Flea called me up the night before that show. I was like, have you heard? So, yeah.
I can't remember. Did you play together with him in the band?
Yeah, for six months.
Was he the drummer when you joined?
Yeah. Me and him were playing with another friend of mine who died just a few years later, but a really great bass player. And me and him and DH were trying to get a band going. Mm. And then DH joined the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I remember.
And then I joined. And I think it was actually probably just a total of about 4 or 5 months that I was in the band.
And did you do gigs? I can't remember.
Yeah, we did. We did a tour for like 3 weeks in the Midwest. We played San Francisco. We played LA, I think twice. We played in Arizona. We played a few scattered gigs in other places. But yeah, I mean, he's the person who introduced me to Flea, you know? Yeah. And yeah, and like his feel as a drummer is just like... It was really fun playing punk with him. I remember the very last time I was pretty sure we were going to fire him, or I knew we were going to fire him at this point, but we had a last rehearsal. And I remember it being just me, Flea, and DH there, and we played Foreign Policy by Fear.
Yeah.
Because you could pretty much just go into whatever punk song, and DH knew how to play it really well.
Yeah.
And I really love that song, Foreign Policy. It's a really beautiful, it's just a beautiful emotive song. And it was a real emotional moment. It was one of those moments I was like, I'm never going to forget this. Like the feel, yeah, you know, the feeling of this, like, because yeah, him and me and Flea had such a good connection, but he wasn't willing to give up the things that were separating him from the rest of us. And it had to go that way. But yeah, we used to have a good time playing together. So when he died, I like listened to those first couple of Dead Kennedys records that he's on and just listening to his groove and stuff. It just felt really good to remember him. But I hadn't talked to him in like 20 years. We were at the same rehab like 20 years ago, right before Californication. And he left after a few days, but that was the last time I'd seen him. But the other guys had been in touch, and I'd been recently like sending Anthony pictures of us with him that came my way to like show him. And he was like wanting to see the pictures and stuff. Like, he was going in a good direction, I thought.
We have to pause the conversation right here, but we'll be dropping the next episode in our Frusciante series next week. In that episode, John continues to play through Red Hot Chili Peppers songs, and he plays a snippet of his solo track Dying Song, and tells us why that didn't end up on By the Way. So be sure to keep an eye out on our feed. You can hear all of our favorite Chili Peppers songs on our playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, Jennifer Sanchez, our editor is Sophie Crane, our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like our show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.